Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. This is Zachary Strebeck, your host and the resident game lawyer. So today we are talking to game developer Shadi Moklashi. Moklashi? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
All right,
yeah.
From Somber Studios. Welcome, Shadi.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I always get people's names wrong, so I just
want no problem.
Make sure
it's not okay. A super common name.
That's okay. So usually what I start off with is, well, first of all, tell me about the game that you're developing now.
So the game is Invisigun Heroes, mm-hmm. and it's pretty much, I've been developing it for about a little over a year and a half now. And it's pretty much a top-down shooter, multiplayer battle arena, and everyone's invisible. So you're invisible too. You basically just have to look for clues in the environment to where people are, and mm-hmm. Lots of stuff will give you away, or like using a special ability or firing. So it's pretty much a single screen stealth game, and just a lot of trickery and keeping your eyes and ears peeled.
Yep, absolutely. So what is your background? Where did you come from? How did you get into the games industry?
I pretty much was born and raised in LA, and I studied computer science in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty much always into just everything technology and computers. And my dad was a high school teacher, and he taught drafting, and he would bring sometimes the classroom would get a new computer, so he'd bring it home to, he'd have like a couple of weeks to learn it before taking it to the classroom. And
yeah,
I pretty much took it over.
Always. Yeah, very cool. Yeah, I had a similar story. My dad used to do spreadsheets and stuff back on a Tandy 1000 or something like that a long time ago.
Oh,
and
man.
We basically took it over for games.
Yeah, that sounds similar. Yeah, my brother and I would do the same thing. And it was just like Mac Classics my favorite was the Amiga 500. And
I never had an Amiga, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
No.
So many good games. Yeah. It was crazy.
So how did you get into the games industry, I guess?
So I studied comp sci, and then I basically did a lot of web development for, I did it kind of through college as just like side jobs. And then I did UI design and UX design full time for a while after college, and basically stayed in web dev for a long time. I mean, I did a lot of like Ruby on Rails work and contract work. And I mean, my heart was still always in games just from, you know, my childhood and growing up.
Of course.
And basically my first, I guess, real foot in the door was when the first iPhone came out, and just the App Store was kind of just a really cool way to self-publish, I think, for, you know, millions of people for the first time, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was kind of unprecedented in that way. At that point, was Steam a major player for self-publishing? I'm trying to think, was it 2005 or something? When did the iPhone come out first? Maybe it hasn't been.
Yeah, I think the iPhone was 2007. Okay. I don't remember when the App Store came out, but that's a good question, because I was pretty late to the Steam party. Mm-hmm. So I don't really remember when it was big, when it started, when it got huge. But
I remember buying Half-Life 2 in like 2004. So
it was
pretty close there. And so I think, self-publishing sort of took off. Yeah, you're right. When the mobile operating systems got huge. And I mean, the barrier to entry there was so small.
Yeah, I mean, it still is the same. Basically, it was $100 a year. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had a pretty solid development background from all the web dev stuff. And I mean, I did a lot of the backend stuff too. So it was just fun to dabble in some, you know, like 2D game engines. And yeah, there was no barrier pretty much. Just make a couple games and let them out. And then I actually still worked in web dev for a long time. And I was just doing iPhone games on the side until a buddy of mine, he had been working in games for a while, and they were starting a game called Hawken. It was like a mech first person shooter.
Yep.
And they worked on it for about 9 months before putting out a trailer on YouTube. It was just like, it was just going to be like a multiplayer Xbox Live arcade game. Mm-hmm. like a $15 downloadable title. And so I helped with the music for the trailer, and basically that trailer just like exploded. It got tons of views and a lot of publisher interest, and
the game looked awesome. So
yeah, it was really, for sure. He's a crazy, I mean, super talented artist, and like pretty rare. He has, you know, both technical and creative mind, I guess. So he really, like, it's crazy looking at his concept art and then how far they got in 9 months, and it was almost identical.
Crazy.
But yeah, so that just kind of exploded and got a lot of investment, and the company grew around it. So that was my first big project. Actually, I guess that was kind of the only real big team I ever worked on, and that was probably a mid-sized company.
Right.
By the time it all wrapped up.
So what drove you to go indie and start your own development?
Basically it was the timing of that. I mean, I always did kind of my own projects just for fun, just prototypes and stuff all the time. But, yeah, when Hawken wrapped up, I mean, I already had like a small prototype for Invisigan, and it was just, we played it at the office a few times just after work, and it was, it just seemed, you know, it was just timing. Like when that, I didn't want to go look for a new full-time gig right away, and I thought I would just give it a shot. I mean, the prototype was fun enough that it seemed like a pretty solid idea. And I really didn't think it would take as long as it has.
I think that's a common problem, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's always the case. So yeah. I really thought it would take me about a year and a half at most. And it's pretty much going to, I think, take about 2.5 when it's all done.
Okay. I mean, I've heard worse, but yeah, I wonder if any listeners know of any games that finished early.
That's true.
I'd like to know. I doubt it's even possible.
Yeah. but yeah, I just decided to give it a shot. So I kind of just used, you know, just went off my savings for the first year and a half. And then, that led up to the Kickstarter. I was pretty much running out at that point.
Right. Well, we'll get to the Kickstarter in a little bit. So let's talk about your company. So do you have some sort of LLC or something like that? This is sort of a business and legal podcast too.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
I like to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, of course. I started Somber Studio, it's an LLC, and it was, I think I formed it maybe about 6 months after starting work on it. Yeah. So sometime it was January of 2015, I think, is officially the LLC date.
Good. Yeah. Well, due to the way that LLCs are taxed in California, trying to get a, you don't want to get like a month out of it in 1 year.
Oh yeah.
Are going to be liable probably for the $800 minimum tax. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I almost did that, and
get your time in, I guess. Yep. You can start wait until January 1st and then file.
Yeah, exactly. But,
okay. So how many other people do you have on the team? Or can you talk about this? Like, are there people that are owners of the LLC, or is it all owned by you?
No, it's just single member. Okay. Which makes a lot of things pretty easy right now. I mean, I obviously don't want it to be single member forever, but, it's just me. And I did contract, some artwork, and I work, with a partner on the music. So, that's pretty much the only other outside work, and it's just contract.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think that having more people on the team would help the development go faster? Or do you feel like Man Month or something? There's that talk or that book where they talk about just throwing more developers at the thing doesn't necessarily make it go faster, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think it depends. I for sure don't really want to do this again for the next project.
Okay.
I mean, it's great, but just like, you know, there's moments where, because I needed the art pretty bad at a certain point, like to move on from where I was, and just having that, you know, just handled, and it came back and it was awesome. And that was just such a good feeling. And like, I mean, I just can't imagine. It saved so much time, and it's just awesome. I'm sure there could be problems, but if it's all running smoothly, it's great to have like totally separate work done in tandem with what you're doing. And, you know, when you're ready for something else, it's there. And But I think the big part is also the motivation. Like, it's really cool to be, you know, inspired to keep working hard all the time if someone else is at the same time. It just, you know, just someone to bounce ideas off.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, luckily I work in an office. It's a shared office with other game developers. So, so I can still, I still have at least, you know, people around that, you know, I can talk to about development stuff and just, you know, play testing and all that.
Right.
Ideas. So,
so it's a game specific co-working space in LA that you're working at?
It's not really, it's actually just an office that we split. So a bunch of
very
us.
Cool.
Yeah. Some of the ex Hawken employees and then, some new people and,
great.
So I just have a desk there.
Okay. But that's good though. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely, it's one of those things where, yeah, it's super important to be involved in a community, even if it's just people in your office that you're always going to have problems and things like that, where you need to ask someone who has experience. I mean, I do the same thing as a lawyer. You know, it's nice to have other people to bounce ideas off of or ask about your problems and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree.
Yeah. So, are you, you were doing this full time at the moment, right? You're not doing freelance on the side or any kind of full-time job.
I still do some, cause I, so for Hawken, I basically did UI design and coding, and then the, I did sound design and the music. So I still, you know, I was really into sound design for a long time. So I still do that for freelance and that actually helped pad, you know, the Invisigun funding for the first year. So
good.
If it was kind of a, depending on the job, I didn't take everything because I felt like I was just kind of stalling the game just for some, you know, extra income. But, but yeah, I still do some audio contract work and music, but that's pretty much it.
It's an interesting balancing act between, because one of the big problems I find that indie developers have is either they have not enough money or not enough time, right? And if you, I mean, where do you find that the balance is?
I'm not sure I plan that well.
Okay.
So I mean, you know, like I said, I thought I'd be done in about a year and a half at most.
Right,
so
you
know, calculating my finances, that was pretty safe, but it definitely needed longer. So. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the Kickstarter, well, I guess we'll get to that, but, I just basically needed more funding. So,
sure.
But it's true. That balance is hard. I mean, there's something, it could be easy to take on some contract work if it paid well, but if it took a lot of time, I'm basically not keeping myself in place, but I'm just delaying what I really want to do, I guess.
Exactly.
And, the longer Invisigun doesn't come out, I just think it's good timing for it right now and maybe not in a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, if you start working on other things and putting off the game, you're going to lose momentum both in your own work and maybe, in your audience, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, if you hear about a game and you're super excited about it and then it doesn't come out for four more years, you know, you without that trickle of, interesting announcements, you're going to lose that interesting momentum.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. For sure.
So, when you started development just on this game, or had you come up with a bunch of prototypes or something like that? I guess you said you had developed it while you were still working on Hawken and played it with that team. But were there any like some of your mobile app ideas or something like that? Were you thinking about maybe making those into full time games, or this was the one? Did you know this was the one right away?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't really have anything solid. I mean, I always keep like a list of just ideas, but I don't. I was pretty into Invisigun already at the time. I mean, it didn't really have a name or anything, but I really liked the idea. And actually, it was kind of a Hawken was all Unreal Engine, so I kind of started Invisigun as like a learning Unity kind of project.
It's good. So, yeah, sometimes that's the best games kind of come out of that, right? You're trying to learn a specific thing, and you know that just becomes the hook.
Yeah, it's true.
Hmm. Where did the idea come from to do Invisigun Heroes?
I know that a lot of the influence comes from, some of the older games like Bomberman. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bomberman's a big influence on it just from aesthetics and simplicity, but, the whole invisible mechanic, I'm pretty sure just comes from like one of my favorite mechs in Hawken had an ability to cloak itself. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I love that mech, and it must have, I didn't think about it at the time, but it must have come from that for sure. it's too similar, you know, time frame. But yeah, I don't know. I think it was just, I don't remember, you know, the idea of everyone being like, in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It could have even just been talking at lunch one time or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Well, I guess it's one of those things where if you really want to come up with all these ideas and find great ideas, you really have to be talking and thinking games all the time, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Is that sort
of remember like the original concept was going to be like a Western. So it was going to be kind of like nighttime in a Western town. And the reason why everyone was invisible is just because it was super dark. And then it was just going to be muzzle flashes like that would show up, that would show characters. So it was just going to be like a rainy, you know, old West town. I still like that idea, but it was a little more limited with, you know, just free reign for special abilities and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. But I think I like the theme, and I think crowds like it too. I mean,
yeah.
Do you think that the art style is something that really attracts players? Cause when I saw you for the first time, I think it was at PAX South, right? I mean,
Austin. PAX South was that was the first time anyone played it pretty much.
I mean, you had a bunch of players there. Every time I walked by the booth, it was full. So, do you think how it looks is what's really drawing the crowd?
I'm not sure. I think, I mean,
not to belittle your programming and design and all the things you put in, but it's definitely a huge factor, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that was the only art style I could kind of handle myself, which is partially why I chose it. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, just to save money for this project, I basically just kind of did the pixel art aesthetic. And I did, you know, there was a lot of feedback on that. A lot of people liked it at PAX. And I think it's just one of those things that would immediately, you know, appeal to some people and immediately turn off some other people. So I didn't really think about it too much. I think, you know, I'm super happy if the game is, you know, caters to a niche audience that loves it. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, financially successful, that's excellent. But I think the aesthetic lends itself well. It's just, it's very simple. Everything is very easy to read. And
It's important for a game like that to be away. You know what you're looking at, right?
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Now, do you think there's a sizable portion of the audience that's instantly turned off by a pixel art looking game?
I think there probably is. They might not be super vocal about it, but everybody, you know, just likes different things. I think for the, like when it was on Greenlight, maybe there was some feedback. Some people were like, I wish it was a different art style or, but you know, a lot of people love it at the same time. So if I learned anything from Hawken, it's just you just can't please everyone. So
that's true.
If you do what you love, and you know, so some other people will love the same thing.
I find that if you do pixel art, I don't know, it generally looks good to me, even if it's not the greatest pixel art. But if you're trying to do like a 3D realistic game, if it doesn't look amazing, looks awful to me, right?
Yeah,
so it's one of those things where, unless you can really go for it all the way, you shouldn't even bother.
Yeah, that's very true. I think without really talented modelers and texture artists, and if you go for like a low poly aesthetic, that helps a lot too.
Right.
But you're right. Like if you're going for realistic with a tiny team, it's if the slightest thing is off. And you put much work into everything. It's just,
It looks bad. Well, and even especially with the perspective that your game is, I don't know, maybe it looks fine for pixel art because you just sort of expect it to look like with that weird kind of on top, kind of on the side, isometric view.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the lighting is inconsistent and it doesn't matter.
As long as it looks good, right?
Right. As long as it reads.
But I mean, a game like Superhot, right? I mean, it's got stylized look to it. It's not realistic or anything. And I think it just, you know, immediately makes you take notice of it, right?
Yeah,
that kind of graphic or art design is super important, especially for indie games.
Yeah, makes total sense. I'm sure basically team size probably is what it comes down to.
Absolutely, yeah. All right, let's talk about your Kickstarter. So you had a successful Kickstarter. It met its goal by about $3,000 extra. Was that like the absolute minimum? How did you set the goal? Was that like the minimum you needed to finish the game, or you thought you needed, or what?
Yeah, pretty much. I just started making a spreadsheet, and it was pretty much the bare minimum for just, you know, I was looking at my expenses to get this far and just projecting it out for one more year. And it's pretty much, just covering expenses, you know, bills, some office stuff, and then you know, I know like closer to release, there'll be more, like some of the legal fees and just, you know, licenses. And then, there'll be a little more contract along the way. So I pretty much just made a conservative goal and, you know, didn't really try to shoot for more than I needed. It was pretty much exactly to fund the rest of it. And, it's amazing how close it was. I mean, like
right.
You know, just like a little more and it might not have been funded. So
sure.
It's super tricky.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it's a huge, another huge balancing act, right? Like, you know, some companies will put it super low just so they're guaranteed to fund, but even though that's not really going to get them to finishing development, which I think to me is pretty shady.
It's very just dangerous actually.
Yeah,
then you have promises, and if you don't have enough money to deliver it, that's...
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
But
I did try to look at other, like, similar Kickstarters that were, you know, same team size, maybe just one to three people, and, like, some other pixel art games, and, you know, just tried to see what their goal was, and it was pretty similar.
Okay. Yeah, I think for me, I would probably, I mean, my way of keeping costs down is to move out of the country and live places that are cheap. So
yeah,
that's living in Los Angeles or San Francisco isn't always the best, the best way, unless you have a reason that you have to live there.
That's true. It is crazy. And I wish
not to put you on the spot.
Who wouldn't want to live? I talk about it with my friends all the time, and I wish we could just like pack up all my friends and we all move exactly the same time somewhere else.
Why not
do it? That's pretty much the only thing keeping me here. Yeah. It's just, you know, all my close friends are right here.
Exactly. It's tough. I mean, I did it a couple of years ago, and I show up every, maybe twice a year to see friends and family.
Oh yeah.
Make new friends on the road. I guess that's the way I do it.
Yeah.
So when you did your Kickstarter video, it's pretty distinctive. It's got a puppet version of you talking and playing the game. What's the story behind that? Where'd that idea come from?
So one of my friends made the puppet, and it wasn't specifically for this. It was just kind of for fun. And, it's actually a really, really cool puppet. Like there's magnets inside. You can swap out like features like the nose and the eyes and,
So it's like a professional level puppet. Huh?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. He makes a lot of like, plush, you know, stuff, and he's always experimenting with that. So it was, just kind of for fun. And then I just, you know, like the kind of game it is, it's hard to make a trailer for it or doesn't. Right. Yeah. So I knew it was kind of going to be like an explanatory video, and I just thought it would be really boring otherwise, like just wanted to bring something else to it. And especially like, I know my, I kind of have like a monotone voice and, you know, like trying to be more excited when you're not, or like, it just, that comes off worse than,
I guess, hey everybody.
Yeah. It's just so, if it's not yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. If it's not yourself, it's way worse.
I understand. Yeah.
So yeah, I just basically thought the puppet was a nice, you know, just a nice way to do it. And I thought it might help spread the video, even if people weren't interested in the game exactly, it would just kind of help spread it around.
Yep.
I was just hoping like other people would share it, you know, around the office or something, other game devs or stuff like that.
Right. So did you, what kind of research did you do besides looking at other campaigns and things like that? What kind of research did you do as far as like, how to run a Kickstarter or, you know, what you should be doing in the year before you start your Kickstarter?
I kind of really started researching it seriously, maybe 3 months before it ran. And I just started looking at, you know, all the successful ones in this, in a similar, not exactly genre, but, you know, like I said, same, similar team size and kind of the smaller budgets. And, I started contacting some of them just for advice. And then, basically just started making lists, spreadsheets of press outlets and, you know, everything I needed to do for it. And I mean, it's kind of a blur now. It's pretty much probably what everyone does, but just preparing a lot of assets and stuff. And then, I mean, that video took a really long time.
Imagine. Did you make it yourself? Who's the puppeteer?
Yeah. So I did the puppeteering and I have a couple of friends who did, you know, like a lot of the off camera stuff. We had like, for some of the effects and stuff, we had like string tied to props and stuff like that. So, I mean, two of my friends helped a lot with the video. So we basically spent a couple of weeks making it. And then, I think I just, you know, standard prep stuff. I wasn't really prepared for the amount of work during the campaign. I think like basically, just the amount of like emailing and contacting, you know, as much press and, you know, streamers and stuff. But, and then PAX was basically, I tried to plan it so that PAX was right in the middle of the campaign, just because I knew that was, you know, everyone talks about the slow middle period of the campaign.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be just perfect to drive some more traffic to it. And since it was a slow period, I could probably handle doing PAX at the same time. And then, so my only real hard deadline was that I didn't want to launch too close to PAX or after. So I was trying to launch around mid-January, and I think it was, it was around then, maybe January 20th, I think.
So did you get good results from being at PAX?
Yeah, that was, so PAX and... On the first day of the Kickstarter, it was mentioned in Kotaku, and I think without those two, I don't think it would have been funded. But and I'm really lucky it worked out, because I just everything pretty much worked
out. Everything sort of fell into place, right?
Yeah, everything kind of fell into place, and PAX was definitely huge, and it was the I was pretty nervous about it. It was the first time people were playing it, and you know, I told some other people I thought it was basically going to be just maybe not a good convention game, like one of those games where you need a few playthroughs to really get it. And it just turned out to not be the case. I mean, everyone got it on their first round. And,
yeah, that's really what it seemed like. I don't know. Yeah, I didn't play it, but I was watching other people play it, and they seemed to all be... I'm terrible at those games, so don't want me playing it.
No problem. Yeah, it was such a relief. I mean...
That's great.
Just a huge relief. After the first day, I was so happy, because it was like, it was just, everyone got it and people were making up their own strategies already and coming back to play it. And just seeing people like get their friends to come back so they could play against each other.
That's
was
the best. Like, I mean, that's really like the best thing you can do. Yeah. Is get them to, because you want people to become your evangelists, right? And people to go out and say, hey, you got to check out this game.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah. And they've already been doing that through the camp, through Kickstarter and after. And it's really awesome.
That's great.
Yeah, PAX was just perfect. Perfect timing. And it's the smallest PAX. So I think it was not too overwhelming. And
yeah, I found that PAX South, after being at PAX Prime, PAX South was way more indie focused and really seemed to, I think a lot of the indie developers there that I talked to seem to really enjoy it and think they were getting something out of it, as opposed to some of the other game conventions. Like if you were at GDC or something like that, I don't think you'd get much out of it.
Yeah.
I feel like people go there because they're fans of all kinds of games and they really want to play. They don't mind playing indie games or indie board games and things like that.
It's good. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Are there any other conventions you plan to go to, or are you sort of keeping your head down now and just trying to get the game?
I'm worked on. Definitely just, yeah, trying to focus on development. And I just, you know, finding out I had to move, and this kind of the last month has been a lot of, you know, not being able to work as much as I could. So I just want to be really responsible with the funding. So
that's good to hear.
But I did, you know, partially plan for part of the funding to be for marketing and conventions. So I'm trying to, I'd like to shoot for PAX Prime because I think that's, that'll be very close to release. So, I think that might be perfect timing for like,
cool. Very cool.
Just, you know, last marketing push before it's out.
Great.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how yet. I think probably I'll try to get in the Indie Mega booth.
Yeah, something that was like what I was going to say. That seems to be the best way in.
Yeah.
Cause you definitely get a lot of support there. I think Intel or Microsoft, they donate the TVs and machines and stuff that you can play it on and all that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So that helps a lot.
Yep. And I think the booth space is less, it costs less than it would normally cost if you were to try to buy something. So,
oh, awesome.
Yeah. I think that's what I heard from Indie Mega booth people last year, or people I've talked to that went there.
Yeah. I think their submissions are soon, maybe June or July. So we'll see.
Yeah. Get on it. So did you do a lot of like building up a mailing list or anything like that before you launched your Kickstarter campaign, or did you just sort of go in blind, like hoping that things like the Kotaku article and maybe there were like less players or something like that doing?
Yeah, I think I didn't prepare as much as I should have there.
Yeah,
I didn't go in totally blind, but I started building up a small, very small following on Twitter, just like. Basically on just some pixel art like hashtags and just sharing some art while I was working on it. But it was really little. I think maybe I had like 300 followers before the campaign started. And then I just kind of hoped it would just pick up steam on its own and with PAX South planned. And then I did have a bunch of contacts in the game industry just from working on Hawken, and a lot of those my former coworkers are working at different companies, so you know I figured they would help a lot in trying to spread the word. So I just kind of went in like that, and like I said, it just like it exactly worked out
right
like not too much more and barely.
Well, I would say that you did it wrong by not really focusing on your marketing beforehand. I mean, even 3 months before, sure. I would say you should have started at least like 6 months before starting to build that up. But again, you know, if you didn't have artwork for the game, if you didn't have really a playable game to show off, it's tough. But you can do it in other ways, right? Like you can, I don't know, blog about just development in general, or rely on the fact that you worked on Hawken, which is a popular game, that kind of stuff,
right?
To start getting your name out there.
It's such a, it's like definitely my weakest. I mean,
it's almost everybody's weakest.
Yeah.
Believe me, you're not alone. And I think this is one of the problems. And this is why a lot of Kickstarters fail, because people don't think about that. They think that it's just sort of going to work itself out. Even people with awesome looking projects that don't hit their goal.
Yeah, it's a hard thing. It's it's like if you're not used to self promotion, it feels so weird at first. I don't know. It's a weird like tone, you know. Just like stay humble, but you're constantly promoting your work. And
yeah, I understand. I was the same way. I mean, when I started my business, I had to just start staying. I'm this game lawyer, right? And meanwhile, like nobody knows who I am, right? So you just have to start establishing your authority just by being being honest, being giving value to people. I mean, that's really what you have to do. And that's what anyone who, it doesn't really matter if you're doing games or some sort of a website, you establish your authority just by providing some sort of value to people. People see that value, and then maybe they'll sign up for your mailing list, or they'll follow you on Twitter or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And I think it's hard to like remember that a lot of stuff seems very different to other people than to yourself.
Yeah.
And like I always try to remember that, but like, you know, even just doing like the voiceover or something.
Oh my god, don't even talk about that. I mean, I can imagine if you don't like your voice, doing a voiceover for an entire 2-3 minute Kickstarter video has gotta be awful. But
oh man, and like sometimes I just thought I sounded ridiculous, like way too,
I know,
way too over the top. And then you listen to it and you're like, that sounds kind of normal, actually. So I just, I'm sure that comes across in other things, like, like self-promotion. And
I mean, I still think that on the, on this podcast, or I was doing board game segments on, on Board Game Law on the Dice Tower podcast, and I thought I sounded like a Muppet. I would freak out all the time. I hated listening to it, so I just wanted to do it all in one take so I didn't have to edit anything. It was just awful. I still think it kind of, but I've just sort of gotten used to the sound of my own voice through my microphone. Yeah. It's very weird, though. And you know what? The sooner you get over that, the better, because you really have to start. If you're the guy that's in charge of your marketing, you need to almost become a personality in yourself.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But I totally understand how scary it is. Did you did you have to reach out to like YouTube streamers or Let's Play or people, other press members? How did that, how did you go about doing that?
I did. And I think that's probably the biggest area where I didn't plan enough, because I, I mean, I definitely had lists. And the thing is, I just forgot that obviously these people, especially the more popular channels, have, you know, their schedule planned out way in advance. So what, not contacting them soon enough, before the Kickstarter, was definitely a problem, because a lot of them turned out to be really interested and couldn't really get back until the Kickstarter was almost over, or even after. Like, you know, I'd get emails that like, oh man, that looks totally awesome. And I just saw it right now.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah,
because there's
like 30 days later.
Yeah, there's so many games and so many, and they're all reaching out to these people.
Right.
I just heard, I don't know if it was my guest last week or at a board game con that I was just at, but someone was talking about reaching out to these people that do reviews of board games like 8 months in advance before you know, just with a, just starting the relationship then, right? And talk about intense. It. And I mean, it's one of those things where you can't just wake up one day and say, hey, I'm going to run a Kickstarter, and then just throw it up there. You really got it. Nowadays, you really have to work hard beforehand.
Right. Yeah. So that, for sure. And they were pretty receptive, but like I said, it was pretty late, a late start. I did get a bunch that helped, and it was awesome. They streamed it and it went really well. And, definitely where some backers came out of those streams. So
That's great.
It was nice. A lot of them are really interested for later, you know, like beta and when it comes out, for sure.
Well, and that's so good. I mean, that's why you need to cultivate those relationships, right? Because you're going to have a number of milestones before you release, and you want to keep, like we said before, keep that momentum going throughout.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I when I was at PAX Prime, I think, maybe, was that it? The people that did the guy that did Castlevania, he was doing a Kickstarter for sort of a new non-Castlevania game, but it was sort of like Castlevania. Anyway, they had a huge panel with a ton of people there, and they were talking about their Kickstarter strategy and planning, and they talked about how they just had this huge spreadsheet, and every day was on it, and each day had to have something going on right during the Kickstarter.
Right.
And you know, you had to plan for that mid-campaign lull and all that. And just some sort of content is coming out every day. And I think that's super important.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to do that because it's a ton of hard work.
Oh, man, it's so much work. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot that could be planned way better. Like, I kind of backed myself into a corner with my rewards, because I think I just... it's really hard to do the math without knowing, like without estimating or without knowing, you know, which reward would be the most popular.
Right.
And so for a while in the middle, I was worried that I was like, wait a minute, if everyone buys all the limiteds, like, will this even be funded? Like, did I even, did I set this up for failure? Or, and then I kind of had the tiers spread in such a way where it made, like a lot of people wanted, we're asking for a tier that would have bundles, like 2 copies or 4 copies of the game, which makes perfect sense for this game. And I kind of couldn't figure out a good way to do it where it wouldn't like cannibalize other tiers. And that could have been planned better for sure. But I think maybe just having multiple people, you know, helping to run a campaign would help a lot.
And people who have done them before, I think, that's probably important, right? Or at least some feedback from someone who's run Kickstarter campaigns before.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you don't feel like I'm getting down on you or anything. I just think that
there's a lot of
lessons that can be learned. I mean,
it's all it's all super interesting.
There's so much to keep in your head when you're running a Kickstarter like that. So before we go, do you have any tips for new game developers, maybe someone who's looking to get into the indie space?
Oh, man.
I don't want to put you on the spot. But
oh, no, it's cool. I think, like, just in general, I think surrounding yourself with like-minded people, I mean, obviously other perspectives are important, but just in my life, I think I've really tried to keep, like, a group of close friends that are really, like, hard workers, you know, and talented people. And it's kind of like one of those things where you, like, when you're little, you know, you're like, I want to work for this company, or, like, you know, I love this company, or these people are my heroes. And but then you don't realize that, like, when your generation grows up, you become kind of the new, you know, like, your heroes become like your peers and your colleagues. And basically just start doing things with your friends and, and, like, eventually, you know, you never know, you'll have, like, a game or a company, and it wasn't even really planned. It was just, like, everybody working on projects together, and stuff comes out of that. And I don't know. I think that's really, like, important, because people are always trying to look for, like, you know, how do I get my foot in the door, or, like,
right,
you know, my resume and just work experience. And I really think there is, like, another avenue, which is kind of just doing it and doing it with other people that have the same goal.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and if you can, like, fund it, you know, with another job, it's maybe not your passion, but if it gives you enough time and money to work on that on the side, then it's just a, I think that's a really good way. But yeah, I guess that would be.
Yeah, I mean, well, advice. It's sort of like, I think they talk about how, I'm trying to think of what I'm talking about. Like, the amount of money you make, like, the closest friends, usually you all make around the same amount of money. I think it's like, if you sort of gravitate toward people who are into the same kind of things that you're into, right?
And so, right. Yeah.
That you kind of support each other and help each other. And, especially if you're all doing game development, you know, you each have your own network, and all those networks sort of overlap, and you're expanding. I mean, it's sort of like how LinkedIn works, right? But in real life, your network of friends just becomes a bigger one and bigger. And eventually you're going to meet those people that can actually make things happen for you, I suppose.
Yeah. Right. And if you're friends with, you know, like, people in different disciplines, I guess that's great. I
mean, definitely helps, especially when it comes down to, you know, you need an artist, or you need, you know, this or that. At least, you know, people who are artists that can help you out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. We're getting to the end. Thank you again for coming on the show, Shani.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
All right. Where can our listeners find you? Where can we find the game?
So somber.com, that's SOMBR.com, is the company site, and all the Invisigun info is there. And Twitter is probably the easiest way, just for, you know, always, like, bite-sized info. And that's at Shadi Radio. That's SHADI Radio.
Now, did you do some sort of radio show or something? Where does that
come from? No, it was that's just kind of been, like, my screen name for everything since college, basically. And it was,
I'm just always curious. People always have usernames that sort of tell you a lot about them, I guess.
Oh, yeah. It's stuck for a long time. It's never, like, that's never taken on anything. So
for a long time, mine was Orko, which is, like, the wizard from He-Man. I just sort of, like, was wondering what I should use as an email address and when I was signing up for Hotmail. And I was like, well, I liked He-Man, so I picked Orko, and then I just used that for 12 years or something.
That's awesome. That totally works.
Yeah. So if you want to find me, don't search for Orko, but look for gamelawyerblog.com, and you can read more about the legal aspects of game development. And make sure you jump on iTunes and put a 5-star review for the show. And lastly, go to patreon.com/legalmoves to donate to the Patreon campaign, help upgrade the show. You know, I have that written in the show notes. I mean, until people actually start Patreoning, I don't know. It basically covers hosting fees and the audio processing, things like that.
Right. Yeah.
So whatever. I mean, it's totally fine. I keep saying it at the end of the show. I don't know why I'm doing this on the air, but, I mean, it's nice to have it up there, and it's a little bit of money every month. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. No, that's really cool.
From a friend and my mother. So that's it. Okay. Well, that's it. Shadi, thanks again for coming on.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
All right. See you all next week.